Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 28th of April. Our guest this hour is the author of Pink Brain, Blue Brain, How Small Differences Grow into Troublesome Gaps and What We Can Do About It. Dr. Lise Elliott is our guest, and we should say that she's the mother of three two boys and a girl. She's a graduate of Harvard, received her PhD from Columbia University, and is a neuroscientist. She's associate professor of neuroscience at the Chicago Medical School of Rosalind Franklin University of Medicine and Science. She's also the author of What's Going On in There, How the Brain and Mind Develop in the First 5 years of life. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Dr. Elliott. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, the email is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hello, Dr. Elliott. Thank you so much for being with us. Very nice to have you here. We talked about the middle-aged brain yesterday, which was interesting for those of us who are middle-aged. It was very reassuring. And today we talk about girls and boys' brains, which is good. It's a good follow-up. You write early on in the book, there is surprisingly, and I think that many of us would have thought it's the opposite, little solid evidence of sex differences in children's brains. You've looked a lot of this data, and you have found that there are only two facts: boys' brains are larger than girls, and girls' brains finish growing about 1 to 2 years earlier than boys. That's the only solid evidence we have?
Well, at this moment. So what I'm reacting to a bit is massive extrapolation in the pop psychology literature and parenting books, telling parents that they're basically their boys are from Mars and their girls are from Venus. And I kind of set out to write that sort of book myself. I'm a neuroscientist. I'd written a previous book on brain development, mother of, you know, a daughter and two sons. I was very curious about the differences in their brains because obviously their behavior is quite different. So I just was enormously frustrated when I tried to read all the latest, not even the latest, just the everything we've got that's published on boys and girls' brains, and really very little has jumped out at me. And so, and you know, sometimes we'll find a difference, for example, in language processing areas of the brain, an area where you would reasonably expect to find a difference between boys and girls because girls do talk about a month earlier than boys. But the people that have studied language development thus far find completely conflicting results. Some say that girls use their left hemisphere more dominantly. Some say boys use their left hemisphere more dominantly. We just don't know at this point. And so to claim that boys are from Mars and girls are from Venus and we need to send them to single-sex schools and we need to raise them differently and have different expectations is, I think, very premature and in many ways unfair to children.
Well, that's interesting because that literature is, as you know, so prevalent that people have done just what you said they've done. They've done, you know, separating sexes from schools and talking about boys who are in trouble and change the way boys are educated, et cetera. It's really caused quite a change in our society.
That's right. You know, I believe it's debatable that we have a, quote, boy crisis in education. You know, I do think that boys have certain vulnerabilities and weaker areas, just as girls do. But you know, nothing has dramatically changed for boys in the last period at all. There's nothing new about the fact that girls read better than boys. The U.S. Department of Education has 40 years of data showing an absolutely consistent gap throughout this period that girls score higher on reading tests. And what's alarming to me is that this reading gap grows with education. So in 9-year-olds, it's more modest, and by the time they graduate high school, it's a larger difference, and that has nothing to do with hormones or chromosomes. It has everything to do with how much time do boys and girls spend reading, how many books do they read, how much text do they expose themselves to, And girls just spend a lot more time doing that. And so if we see differences in the brain, we really need to ask ourselves, how are kids training themselves?
Mm-hmm. What about what you see? Please put this into the whole picture here with your children. You see your boys who are trying to stuff everything they can into a DVD or VCR or something. You see your daughter who's putting all the little animals down for their nappies. I mean, the behavior is pretty remarkably different.
Well, absolutely. I mean, and I think every parent notices this. We assume, or we, you know, we're led to disprove the hypothesis that there's no sex differences. Every parent, you know, kind of believes their child's a blank slate, and then they discover, oh my gosh, my son just adores those dump trucks that his
right.
cousin handed down to him. My daughter adores pink, and but you know, the children are remarkably sophisticated, and I'm absolutely not claiming that there are not innate differences. Certainly, the difference in toy choice is quite profound. In fact, it's just about the largest behavioral sex difference we have. It's much larger. If you put three-year-olds in a playroom with a choice of trucks and balls or dolls and beauty sets, they'll separate themselves about 80%, 20%, the boys and girls. That's one of the largest gender differences there is. If you test children's verbal skills, math skills, you know, even empathy, even some of the interpersonal things that we assume are so different, the differences are much, much smaller, much more like a 60-40 split. So there's much more overlap and similarity between boys and girls than there is difference between the average boy and girl. But, you know, as humans, our brain, as adult brains, we like to categorize things. It's the world is complicated, and we like to put things in boxes, big and little, pink and blue. And so parents do notice these differences, and I think we kind of blow them a little bit out of proportion, in part because we don't appreciate our own contribution to these differences. So while baby boys and baby girls actually don't show a preference for trucks over dolls, actually all babies under the age of 9 months or so prefer to look at dolls because they have faces, and every child is instinctively programmed to look at the human face because that's where they get their protection. And then what happens, and this is the whole sort of thesis of my book, is these small innate biases do come to the fore, and then they get reinforced and self-perpetuated because of our very gender-divided culture and children's own need to gender identify, to decide, I'm a boy, I'm a girl. And once they figure that out at about age two or three, they're very, very motivated to live up to the standards that they see in their playmates, that they see mm-hmm. in Toys R Us, that they see on every movie and video. So both things are important, but we have obviously more control over the social influences than over the hormonal ones.
Mm-hmm. And what about the expectations we have? A couple reviewers of your book picked up this story of mothers bringing their 11-month-olds to a lab so that the babies could crawl down a carpeted slope, and then the mothers could change the angle of the slope, and they thought that their 11-month-old boys would be much stronger, able to navigate that better than the girls. But it turned out the girls and boys proved equally adept at crawling and also at risk-taking.
That's right, and that just sort of demonstrates. And there's many other studies that show that parents' expectations for boys and girls differ early on. Out on the playground, parents are much likelier to caution their daughters about, you know, climbing too high on the play structure. Even with newborn babies, there's these great, you know, gender disguise studies where they'll take a boy and dress him up in pink, or they'll just dress a child neutrally and not tell an adult, whether it's a boy or a girl, and that's very disconcerting. People have a hard time talking even to newborn baby, young babies, if they don't know. So anyway, in the gender disguise example, if an adult perceives or believes that a child is a girl, they'll tend to comment more on her beauty, appearance, delicate nature, sweet demeanor. And if it's a boy, adults tend to comment more on their size, strength, intelligence, and so on. So, you know, we still haven't gotten to a truly gender neutral.
I guess it starts right off the bat, huh?
Absolutely. And, you know, there's not a lot, you know, we can try to fight that, but it's this implicit bias, these implicit expectations, as lots of psychologists have popularized lately, are hard to beat. I mean, we do it for race, we do it for gender. It's crucial to be aware of our biases to try and overcome them, but it's hard to do that on a constant basis. So, you know, I think we need to do some deliberate kind of cross-training, is my whole point of view, that if girls are biased and then if our culture reinforces the development of their verbal and interpersonal sorts of relational skills, then what we need to do is step in and build up the things that they're going to need later on, like some of the spatial skills that prove very important for higher math and science, and which boys are more inclined to get more practice at from all their ball play and building toys and so on. And as we know from studies of the brain, it's remarkably plastic in early life. I'm not saying we can't learn things as adults, and I know you were discussing that in yesterday's program, but there is what we call critical periods in early development, when a child's brain is uniquely open to learning certain things about their environment. And so the more gender stereotyped their early exposure is, the harder it's going to be to develop those non-traditional skills later on.
Right. And this is where your research is, right, in the area of plasticity, where the brain, and tell me how this happens, what goes on inside the brain so it actually changes in response to its own experience?
That's right. I mean, learning is a key component of brain development. It's not something that's superimposed on a developed brain. Learning is actually what wires up the brain in early life and even throughout life, continuing throughout life. You are good at what you do every day, and we're not very good at the things we don't do. So the way this works is we say that neural circuits are activity-dependent, meaning anything that excites electrical activity in a particular circuit, let's say vision, the kinds of visual stimuli you're exposed to, or maybe a more intuitive example is language. So the language that you're exposed to early in life, if it's English or Russian or Mandarin, actually forges the neural connections, the neural circuits that allow you to precisely hear and produce the sounds of that language. So if you're not exposed to Mandarin in your first dozen years of life or so, you're going to have a much more difficult time actually hearing the difference and between their speech sounds that we don't have. And so those circuits aren't in place, and they can't be put to use as well later in life.
Mm-hmm. And what is it? I can't remember this. It's lodged in the recess of my mind. If you don't learn language after a certain number of years, it's almost impossible for you to be able to speak any language.
Oh.
What is that?
Yeah, so fortunately, that's very rare that a child grows up with no language. The most common situation that happens is if a child is born profoundly deaf in both ears and the deafness is not detected early on. Normally, if a child's profoundly deaf, we try to immerse him or her in fluent sign language, which has all the same grammar and sophistication as a spoken language. Or nowadays, actually, many babies are being implanted with cochlear implants if the nature of the deafness is something that can be treated with an implant. But for the rare child that is not exposed to any language in the first 4 or 5 years of life, it becomes extremely language. That's right. And so what we think happens is that our cerebral cortex is multipotential, and if it's not exposed to language, the parts of the brain that would have wired into language circuits wire into something else, like memory or enhanced sensory processing or perhaps even emotional perception. But, you know, once you get beyond a certain point, you can't wire up a circuit that was unstimulated early in life.
Right. Fascinating. All right, let's welcome phone calls. Dr. Lise Elliott is our guest, and we're talking about her book, The Pink Brain, Blue Brain, How Small Differences Grow into Troublesome Gaps and What We Can Do About It. She writes, scientists can no longer pit nature and nurture against each other as distinct warring entities. They appreciate that they're intricately interwoven, so fully developing the mental characteristics known as the male and female brain also depends on each child's automatic immersion into either the male or female culture. Each is powerful as the lullabies we sing and the nourishment that we provide. We welcome your phone calls. So join us, won't you? I'm sure that many of you have observations of your own children or their students or your nieces or nephews or grandchildren. Would you agree that there has been way too much made of these differences, and that the differences that there are can be changed in some ways by practice, role models, and reinforcement that boys and girls are exposed to from birth onward? Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this hour, I want to remind you that it's our comedy show. We haven't had one, and it's not that we haven't needed it, but we just haven't had one, I'm sorry, for a long time. So tomorrow it's a combination of new comics and classic comics we all know and remember and still laugh at the bits that are done by those performers. 10 to 11 tomorrow, we're going to either belly laugh or chuckle or smirk. It'll be fun, I assure you. Let's go to phone calls. Now we have quite a few of them. We start our calls with Erica from Oshkosh. Hi, Erica.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Good.
Good.
I'm just kind of wondering, I work at a daycare, and I'm really learning a lot about how the importance of how you treat a child and how you talk to them connects. And I was just wondering about abuse. If a child is abused between the ages 1 to 5, how does that affect them later on in life?
Because the brain is so sensitive to early experience, abuse can be extremely damaging. As we know from long-term studies of individuals, you know, many mental health issues are exacerbated by early abuse. For example, depression in girls is known to be related to early sexual abuse. Early physical abuse definitely increases aggression later on, and particularly parents who were abused as children are likelier to abuse their own children. That's been well documented. But, you know, there's also some good news that comes out of this. And, you know, I think people that have been around children do appreciate that a certain proportion are remarkably resilient. And so even the most extreme deprivation or neglect anyway, for example, there's studies of the children raised in Romania during the previous regime, the Ceausescu regime, where it was this terrible warehousing of infants in orphanages. And fortunately, they were adopted out into warm, loving homes. And, you know, generally speaking, the earlier the child was adopted, the better the outcome. But there was a certain, even among those adopted late, after age 4 or 5, about 20% managed to recover and come through unscathed. And we don't know precisely why, if it was just intrinsic traits of those children or if the environment was somewhat better for them. But, I think there's encouraging news that it's not absolutely a deterministic problem.
Thank you, Erica, so much for your call. Here's an email, an interesting one from Betty, who's taught at both elementary school and middle school. I observed that the subject matter of the drawings of girls was limited to walls and rooms of their homes, the furniture, and the rather wooden figures of mothers and fathers. The boys had a much wider range of subject matter. I attribute this to the fact that the boys were allowed a wider range in which to play, ride their bikes, while the girls were and still are restrained in home because of safety concerns. I feel that this lack of sensory experiences has been the cause, and the brains of girls are hampered by this restriction in ways that we do not calculate.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, it's definitely true that boys range farther afield than girls in playing from their homes. I mean, I think all children now are more restricted than we were a generation ago because of concerns about safety and the huge cars we have barreling down the streets these days. It's, you know, given that parents discourage girls' exploration on the playground, I'm sure there is probably some truth in the idea that they don't let their daughters range as far or stay out as late and all that. At the same time, it is another reliable and undoubtedly hardwired difference between boys and girls is in activity level. On average, boys are more physically active than girls. Again, it's not a 90-10 split. It's more like a 35-65 split in this case. Because boys are more active, they're going to want to get outside more, and so they are going to expose themselves to a wider variety of things.
Mm-hmm. How did we get, you asked this question, and I'd really like to know the answer, from accepting the different strengths and weaknesses of each sex to assuming that these differences are fixed by nature? I mean, how do we get to this point?
You know, I think it's part of it is a misunderstanding about the brain. And, you know, we have now all these beautiful brain imaging studies that, you know, images that get published in Time magazine and your local newspaper and showing men's brains and women's brains, and somehow I think people assume that biological difference is hardwired difference. You know, that's biology, that's cells and tissues, you know,
yes.
That's unchangeable. But the more you understand about neuroplasticity, the more you appreciate that, no, it's not fixed, that just because you see a difference between adult men and women tells us nothing about the cause. It may be hormonal and genetic, but it may very well be a matter of, you know, how they spent the last 25 years before they got stuck in that MRI scanner, which obviously the experience growing up as a boy or girl is quite different.
Kyla from Madison, hi.
Hi. I was just thinking about how we often think about our brain as, like, controlling everything. I was wondering if you could comment on how hormonal differences and everything might also affect the differences between boys and girls and mm-hmm. also affect how the brain functions.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I do try to explore hormones a lot in this book. Basically, you know, I assume you're talking about sex hormones because the other hormones don't differ so much between boys and girls. Hormones like testosterone, estrogen, progesterone, these actually influence our bodies and brains at two different phases of life. One is before birth. So actually, children aren't exposed to estrogen before birth because it's not able to cross the blood-brain barrier. But boys' brains are exposed to testosterone beginning about 8 weeks after conception. And that testosterone is crucial for creating the right male body. And it also does influence behavior. So that activity level difference that I was talking about a moment ago is very likely shaped by prenatal testosterone. And even the toy preference seems to be influenced by prenatal testosterone, probably a preference for moving objects. And we know that because of girls who are exposed, because of a certain genetic defect, exposed to high levels of androgens, male hormones, before birth. And these girls do show a sort of shifted toy preference. They're kind of between boys and girls in their preference for trucks and balls. So prenatal testosterone does have some influence on behavior, but it has not been linked to, for example, the difference in verbal skills. There's no evidence that boys' exposure to testosterone before birth is why they speak later than girls. Now, there's probably some little bias there that's doing it, but it's not testosterone. Now, after kids are born, there's no difference between testosterone or estrogen levels in boys and girls. We call this the latent period. Freud called it the latent period. You know, they're not interested in sex, and their sex hormones are not any different. So when we see boys running around on the playground, we can't say, oh, it's the testosterone. I mean, it was the testosterone before birth, but it's not the testosterone when they're 8 years old. Now, once they hit puberty, of course, that all changes. And there's been tons of research looking at what we call the activational effects, these adult effects of hormones on thinking and emotional differences. And in that case, the data are surprisingly weak. Again, I went into this book thinking I would be able to explain the spatial and verbal and emotional skills based on some of these hormone differences. But the studies that were so suggestive, for example, studies of postmenopausal women who are taking estrogen. This was a beautifully randomized, placebo-controlled study, the Women's Health Initiative, which we believed was going to show that estrogen was beneficial for women's verbal skills and memory skills. And it turned out that this very large study found no difference between women on estrogen and women not. In fact, those on estrogen showed a somewhat elevated risk for Alzheimer's and dementia, which was quite alarming. So we now think that, you know, these activational effects of hormones on our thinking and emotional skills are very, very subtle and not the main basis for why men and women seem so different.
Hmm. Anything more, Kyla?
No.
Okay.
That's very interesting. Thank
yes.
You.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. What are the implications from all of this on how we direct our children? I know that you have specific advice for parenting and also for teaching that there may be some areas where if you look at chess clubs, if you look at certain kinds of math groups, et cetera, they do tend to be dominated by boys. What can girls, given that there are some differences and they tend to become amplified, where should we be directing both boys and girls so that they can fill out their brains and, you know, be full human beings?
Right. Well, I think just by sort of being aware of these different cognitive modules, as we call it, you know, that even within academic sorts of skills, it's not just reading, writing, arithmetic. There's also these important spatial abilities and memory skills and a wide range of things. And also by starting young. I mean, you know, when kids are little, that's kind of when we indulge this pink-blue stuff the most avidly. And, you know, I'm not saying you want to deprive your sons of trucks or your daughters of dolls, but I do think we need to make an extra effort with boys to promote their verbal skills, to talk to them, because it's known that girls and mothers talk to each other more than mothers and their sons, or even fathers and their sons. So girls are getting more verbal stimulation. They're kind of provoking more verbal stimulation, and we need to counteract that and try to converse with our boys, not just one way, not just talking at them, but really listening and really focusing on the content of what they're saying, not if they're stuttering, not if they're making any pronunciation errors, which all young children do. And then especially to read and sing and play rhyming games with young boys. We know that early verbal skills translate quite directly into literacy, reading and writing skills. So if we can teach boys their letter sounds and their rhyming skills early on in a very fun, play-based way, we can't do drill and kill with young children, but a little more attention in that area has been proven quite beneficial for any child, and particularly boys, to develop those early literacy skills. For girls, I think we need to pay a little more attention to some of these spatial skills. And luckily, you know, we are getting more girls into athletics, which has been beneficial.
Yes, very beneficial, I think.
In so many ways, mm-hmm. You know, both for promoting physical health and positive body image, which turns out is the biggest risk factor for depression in teenage girls, is how they feel about their bodies. And so those who are more physically active tend to have a better body image. But as well as girls' comfort with competition, because this becomes a big issue out in the workplace, part of our glass ceiling is simply explained by the fact that women aren't as willing to put themselves out there for the big job. So I think you see this in girls who are athletes, whose fathers are very encouraging of daughters' athletics. It gives them a tremendous amount of confidence and assertiveness. And there's even some evidence that this translates into spatial skills, into being able to visualize things in three dimensions and the kind of ability that is important for trigonometry and engineering and those kinds of areas.
Let's go to Mike from Madison next. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I have an 8-year-old girl and a 5-year-old boy, and we pretty much raised them the same and you know, weren't big on introducing gender-type toys. But, I mean, my wife and I were both amazed when our son got to be, like, 3, how everything became a sword, and he wanted to kick everything. And we didn't even have a lot of these kind of toys, but he fell in love with Power Rangers and all this stuff. I mean, how do you explain that kind of difference?
Well, you know, parents do try to do this. But as I was saying earlier, we can't completely wipe out all of our gender bias when we interact with our children. We do a lot of it subconsciously. But on top of that, we're growing up in a culture. These kids are not ignorant of what's on television, what's in their books, what's going on in preschool. You know, there's been a lot of analyses of movies and TV shows for kids where boys are usually the more active, assertive characters. You know, most movies, men are the more violent warrior types. You know, so what happens is boys have this bias, and then they see it reflected in the culture, and they want it. They want the gun. They want the sword. They want to, turn anything into a shooting device. But the good news about the aggressive difference in children is that it goes away. By the time we're adults, there's actually no difference in physical aggression between the average man and the average woman. Yes, at the far tail of the extreme, the males are more violent aggressors. But if you sample a large enough population, you'll see a surprisingly small difference in physical aggression between adult men and women. So it's something that we can train away, and ultimately, in spite of our initial biases, plasticity wins in terms of sex differences in aggression.
Thank you, Mike, for your call. Alice from Zion. Hi, Alice.
Hello.
Hi, you got something on in the background that's distracting.
Just a minute. Hello.
Hi, Alice.
Hi, good morning. I have a question in regard to my concerns that so many of the boys today that are being tested and all for ADHD and autism has a much higher rate than that of girls. And I'm just wondering if your guest relates that to just genetic factors, or does this also have something to do with role-playing and the environment?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question and a deep problem, because autism in particular is a you know, serious concern and tremendous burden for parents and society. So what I'll say about autism is that it does seem to be a strongly genetic disorder. Something like 80% of the risk for autism is believed to be genetic. However, nobody has yet identified any difference in gene expression or a sex-linked gene that would explain why boys are diagnosed about 4 times more often than girls. Now, some people believe that perhaps autism is underdiagnosed in girls, that because of their better verbal skills and because autism is a somewhat of a communicative deficit, it's mostly a social awareness deficit, but that girls are being missed with autism. So that's one thing. And likewise for ADHD, attention deficit, boys, as I mentioned, are more physically active, but if you take out the H part, the hyperactive part, the just inattentive type, which is more of an issue probably for school performance, girls approach boys much more closely in that sort of diagnosis. And you start seeing that in the teen years, more girls being diagnosed with ADD. So, you know, I wish I could tell you. I certainly have studied the scientific literature to see if there was something sex-linked in the genes for these disorders, and thus, at this moment, there's not. So, you know, I think we need to be aware of maybe some biases in diagnosis rates, but also the fact that when you talk about any disorder, and I was talking about highly violent men, or when you're talking about autism, we're looking at the tail end of the curve. And so you can have a very small difference between the average boy and girl, but a large difference in the number of children at the extreme who are diagnosed with something like autism or ADD. So, you know, what I hope we don't do is kind of extrapolate or stereotype from these disorders to assume that all boys are not capable of emotionally connected or are hyperactive.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Thanks very much for your call, Alice. Can you talk about this D difference value? One statistic you say that we cannot avoid is the D value.
Mm-hmm.
What is that?
Well, even for people who've never taken statistics, it's a pretty easy thing to understand. If you give some kind of test to a large group of people, like verbal fluency, this is one. You've probably heard the urban legend that women speak 20,000
yes.
words a day and men speak 7,000 words a day.
Right.
Well, happily, that's been debunked. Somebody actually strapped some recorders on college students and found that both men and women speak about 16,000 words a day, if you want to know the exact number. But if you do a study and you measure this verbal fluency, which is how many words can you spit out in 30 seconds that begin with the letter B? I know it sounds crazy, but this is the kind of thing cognitive psychologists do. Bring you to the lab and ask you to, and, you know, a woman will come up with ball and beauty and bug, and a man will come up with a bunch of words. And on average, women are able to spit out more words per minute than men are. And the D value for that is 0.3. So what does that mean? It means that if you take the average score of women and subtract the average score of men and then divide it by the standard deviation, which is really a spread of the curve, how much variance is it, you get this D value. So just three little numbers subtracted and then divided. And what a D is described of is in terms of a standard deviation. So standard deviation describes two-thirds of the area under the curve, one-third on each side of the top, if you think of a bell curve, right? So something that differs by a whole standard deviation is a D value of 1 is considered a very large effect. And so something that differs on the large side is our height. Men are about 6 inches taller than women, and that actually is a D value of 2, which is enormous. But something like our verbal skills, as I mentioned, is a D value of 0.3, so a third of a standard deviation. This is just a little shift, and I have a picture in my book showing a little bit of a shift of the bell curve so that the top is a little bit more to the right for women than men. If you look at these two bell curves, what really strikes you is the fact that they are enormously overlapping, that the range of ability within men or within women is much, much greater than the differences between us. So diversity is the rule, and gender differences are just a small part of that variance.
The author of Pink Brain, Blue Brain, How Small Differences Grow into Troublesome Gaps and What We Can Do About It, Dr. Lise Elliott, is our guest this hour. Our phone lines are filled, but keep the number in mind and try in a little while. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jared in Green Bay, our next caller. Hi, Jared.
Hello there.
Hi.
Hi. I just had a little bit of commentary. I'm not a parent. I'm obviously not old enough for that, but I do have two younger cousins. They're about, 9 and 11 at this point. And, you know, I've just sort of been able to, you know, sort of see them grow up, so I have kind of a perspective on this. And one thing I've kind of, you know, noticed is, I used to have a big, set of Legos, and when I got older, we basically tossed this entire great big thing full of Legos and instructions on there, and I thought it was very, very illuminating to see the different, you know, things that they would build. The youngest one, he's a boy, and he, you know, would always want me to build the old stuff that had instructions, or he'd want to build space things or gun things, and, the slightly older one, she's 11, she started out with, like, you know, kind of like building houses, and then she moved on to, like, abstract things and functional things. So he'd build a space fighter with guns, and she'd build a cool satellite with a few arms and scanners and whatnot. I'm just wondering if, like, how consistent this is with you, Sina, or if you've ever used anything like Legos in your studies.
Sure. Well, that's great. And I have to say, I think it's terrific that they're both playing with Legos, because that's a great way to build these three-dimensional spatial skills, and particularly, you know, translating from 2D designs to 3D designs. I thought you were going to tell me you gave them the Legos and your niece wasn't interested and your nephew was. So it's terrific that she's playing with them. And frankly, the differences you're describing are a lot less dramatic than often is said to be the case, you know, that the girls would kind of stop with the houses, and that would be it. I think it's great your niece is moving on to the satellites, and maybe your nephew can move in that direction, too. There are, as I'm not trying to say there aren't innate differences, and it particularly shows up in children's interest level, but there's a lot of environmental influence that overplays, lays on top of that. And you've just demonstrated that. Just giving your niece the Legos, and she's using them, and she's, promoting those skills. My daughter loved Legos when she was little. And then, you know, as she got more hanging around with peer groups, and I discovered in middle childhood, somehow Legos aren't a girl thing anymore. After she was maybe 8 or 9, unfortunately, Legos weren't considered a girl thing. And in fact, if you go to the Lego store, it's largely marketed towards boys now. It's mostly, you know, vehicles and Star Wars and more male-themed items than female, which is kind of a shame.
Thank you, Jared, for the call. Rob is on the road joining us. Hi, Rob.
Hi. I'd like the doctor to comment on something. A number of years ago, there was a story in the Rolling Stone about a particular individual, granted only an individual, as a baby, was born with ambiguous genitalia. The decision was made to excise the abnormality and raise the boy as a girl. And the parents bought into this and did it from day one. But as this individual grew up, rejected girls' toys, wanted to play with trucks, rejected girls' clothing. And when this person hit puberty, was given hormones to make the transition, but was always miserable, always mm-hmm. felt like a boy trapped yeah. in a girl's body.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, well, this individual's story came out. He learned of what happened to him and, you know, published his story, but he didn't meet with a very good ending.
Yeah. Well, thank you for raising that. And I do discuss that case. It's a very famous case. And the Rolling Stone article turned into a book, As Nature Made Him, by John Colapinto, which is a fabulous, really good reporting. But the thing about that particular case, and it was actually famous long before, because this child was actually an identical twin. He had a twin brother, and they were both born perfectly fine, but there was the circumcision accident when the boy was 17 months old. It was very tragic. And the parents deliberated and debated and talked to a lot of doctors. And finally, when he was, David was the boy's name, when he was 21 months, they decided to convert him, to raise him as a girl. And And indeed, it was not a successful mission at all. The boy continued to want to play with boy things. He even wanted to urinate standing up. Mm-hmm. It was such a tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
And finally was able as an adult to revert back to a male gender. But the problem with that case, and generalizing from this one case, is that we now know that 21 months is just way too old to try to gender convert somebody, that there's so much gender learning that happens in the first year and a half. For example, babies, even in the first 3 months of life, can tell the difference between male and female voices, male and female faces. In the toddler years, they're able to sort things into piles of that belong for men and piles or for boys and piles that belong for girls. So trying to shift this poor kid, especially when he had an identical twin brother to whom he was very bonded, to whom he played with at all hours of the day, was just a very bad idea. Now, there has been another case of a child with a similar circumcision accident, in this case at 2 months of age, and he was raised as a girl from shortly thereafter, I think beginning about 5 months, and that was a much more successful shift. And so the child now grew up into a woman who regards herself as a woman. So I'm not saying that we want to gender shift anybody. I think the movement now for children born with ambiguous genitalia is to try as much as possible to stick to the hormonal and genetic orientation. But there is more plasticity in gender identity than that one case would suggest.
Very interesting.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure. Thanks very much, Rob, for bringing this area up. Gloria is next from Madison. Hi, Gloria.
Hi. I just want to say thank you so much for writing this book. I am a grandmother, and I see way too much separation of the kids into, you know, girl and boy. When I was raising my children in the late 60s and early 70s, there was a movement to get rid of some of the gender distinctions. And I think that it ended up with a lot more variety in terms of what girls and boys could do. Now I see so much, you know, princess stuff for the little girls and, you know, all the male stuff for little boys, and it's very limiting. But I have a question. Have you looked at farm families at all, where in some cases there's, I think, a lot more freedom for the girls because they have to take on a lot more, you know, chores, et cetera?
Oh, yeah, that's really interesting. Well, I totally agree with you about different generations. I grew up in an era when girls were encouraged to do boy things, and we actually believed there was, there was more malleability there than I think we do today. And so this putting boys and girls in different slots is causing problems. You know how hard it is to get boys to sign up for chorus in high school or to write for the school newspaper?
Yes.
Or, you know, it's just crazy. Everything has a gender label now. Every activity is for boys or for girls. It's limiting people. So I think that growing up on a farm would probably be terrific, particularly if the girl's out there and she's able to drive the tractor like her brother and, you know, have all those same opportunities. Mechanical skills are something we all need better, and girls in particular, you know, it's less likely for dad to call his daughter over when he's tinkering with the car or the radio or whatever. But girls could benefit from that kind of experience.
Oh, yes. I wish I had learned all of that.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that your book is wonderful and it's such a strong contribution, one of the things that's troubling here is that the data that you write about, you say in the intro, rarely gets verified before it hits the media. So, and also that studies that look at differences between men and women are more interesting and more likely to be published. What's happening to truth in all of this?
Yeah, it's something we call the file drawer effect in science, that, you know, you work hard to do an experiment, and if you find a positive result, you find a significant difference, you find something that's statistically reliable, you know, you get to publish it. But if you find a lack of difference, journals aren't very interested, and they always, you know, there's just this sense that, oh, maybe there's something wrong with your experiment. And all that data gets left in the file drawer. It never gets published. And so we get this distorted sense of the differences when only the positive differences are reported. And so in the book, I talk about, for example, language differences that were thought to be due to this story that women use both hemispheres to talk and men usually primarily use the left hemisphere. This was based on one rather small study that came out in 1995 in a very high-profile journal, got published, that's Nature, for those of you who know, and then that was written up in every newspaper, Time Magazine and the New York Times.
Oh, my.
Every local paper carried this story of this fundamental difference between men and women's brains that seemed to explain verbal differences. Well, it turns out by 2008, we've had about more than 20 studies that have tried to do the same experiment. And when you put all that data together, there is no difference in this lateralization, that both men and women primarily use our left hemispheres for speech. You're not going to see that in Time Magazine.
Right, right. Thank you so much for being with us. We're out of time. It was a very interesting hour and great book. Thanks.
Thank you.
Dr. Lise Elliott, the book is Pink Brain, Blue Brain, How Small Differences Grow into Troublesome Gaps and What We Can Do About It. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production and for producing this program. And thanks for all of your calls. A reminder, tomorrow, comedy at 10 o'clock. So keep listening. Great things ahead.